Committee will please come to order. If everyone would please take your seats.
I don't want to sit by you.
Oh, thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the first meeting of the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. It looks like we might have some members drifting in, but we do have a sort of an ambitious agenda today, even on the first day. So we're going to start with some introductions, as you see on the agenda, and then we're going to move to our nonpartisan House staff is going to give us overviews of some of the areas under our jurisdiction. And there's a lot under our jurisdiction, so we want to give as much time to them as we can. And so as we begin, we're going to first, we're going to introduce our committee page. I didn't warn her, but there she is. So I'm going to ask you to, I'm going to start with you. If you would introduce yourself, give us your name, where you're from, and then we'll go from there.
Okay. My name is Karen Brunelton, and I'm from Edina. And I was actually a page on in the 2011 Health and Human Services Reform at the time. So I'm happy to be working with all of you again this session.
Hey, thank you. Welcome. It's really important to know who the pages are in the various committees. They are very helpful and important. And then we have partisan research staff in the committee, and I know that our DFL partisan staffer who's assigned here is out ill right now, and Leah Montgomery, and then her, if you could just mention your name.
I'm David Sullivan with House DFL Research, and I'm just filling in today for Leah Montgomery, who's feeling ill, but she should be back the next time you meet.
Okay, thank you. And then who's our Republican?
Hello, Harry Kennedy, Republican Caucus Research.
Okay, welcome. And then our nonpartisan House Research staff, if you would just introduce yourselves.
I'm Randy Chun with House Research, and I should say for members that there's a list of analyst subject matter divisions in your folders so you know who does what among us.
I'm Emily Cleveland with House Research.
I'm Lynn Aves with House Research.
And Danielle Pinelli with House Research.
Okay, thank you. And we just realized that they don't have nameplates today, but there are nameplates, and hopefully they'll have them in future meetings, and that'll help everybody. And then our committee legislative assistant.
My name is Lynn Sando. I'm this committee's legislative assistant. I have a background in human services and mental health with a master's degree in counseling and psychological services.
Thank you. Great. And our committee administrator.
My name is Matthew Bergeron. I'm the committee administrator for this committee. I'm an attorney by trade and have a background in human services from the public county side.
Great. And I'm Tina Liebling from Rochester, and we're going to just go around and have the members all introduce yourselves. And what I'd like you to do, we're going to do this pretty quickly, but if you just have a word or two about your particular interest or background in health and human services, if you have one. If you don't, that's fine too. But if you could just give us a word about that, and we'll go around the table. Representative Abler.
Yeah, Jim Abler from Anoka. I have a passing interest in this topic, and it's kind of fun to see everybody come back. It's almost like the first day of school. We got some new kids on the committee here. It'll be kind of interesting to. Some aren't so new, but anyway, but this will be fascinating, and we have a lot of work to do, and I think you're going to be a great chair, Madam Chair. So.
Thank you. Flattery will get you everything.
Okay.
I'm Tara Mack, and I represent Apple Valley and part of Lakeville, and prior to my legislative life, I worked at a nonprofit that dealt with kids in the foster care system, so always have an interest in that.
And, thank you. And Representative Mack is our Republican lead on the committee, newly appointed, so appreciate her assistance.
Yeah, Representative Grunhagen, I'm from House District 18B, which is Sibley and McLeod County. I have a long interest in health care. I started selling health insurance back in 1978, and I was only going to do it till I could find something decent to do. But it's been 30-some years. But it's almost like marriage, no? But
don't go there.
Yeah, don't go there. I have a particular concern about government program reimbursement rates to doctors and hospitals and how they've been aggravated the health care industry, especially in terms of cost shifting to private health insurance and the negative effect that's had on our small group and individual market.
Thank you.
My name's Nick Zerwas. I'm from 30A, Big Lake Elk River. And have a background in healthcare policy as a volunteer and advocate.
Thank you. Welcome.
Joe Schumacher from Southwest Minnesota. My areas are mainly in nursing homes, but it's an ever-expanding group of interests that I collect.
Madam Chair, Tony Albright from 55B, which is the middle third of Scott County. I've spent the last 25 years assisting independent clinics and hospitals with their retirement programs, so having had an awareness and membership with their community in these issues, so thank you.
Thanks. Welcome.
Madam Chair, I'm Joanne Ward, District 53A. That's western part of Woodbury, South Oakdale, South Maplewood, and all of Landfall. My background is pretty broad and general in terms of health and human services, with the exception of, I will say, one of my most recent experiences is working in a very effective anti-bullying program with elementary and junior high students, in which gave us an opportunity to discover a lot of issues that children needed help with. And my younger son is an ER doctor, and we have lots of conversations about issues associated with medicine.
Thank you.
I'm Patty Fritz, representative from District 24B. That's parts of Rice, Steele, and now Dodge County. I've been a nurse in the nursing home industry for 35 years and lobbying up here on nursing home issues and workers up in those nursing home issues for 45 years. I'm glad to be back.
I'm Representative Tom Huntley from District 7A, which is the northeastern part of the city of Duluth. I am also chair of the Health Care and Human Services Finance Division. My main interests are health care reform. We need to change the way we pay for health care, and particularly in how we treat people with chronic diseases. 80% of the money we spend in healthcare is spent on people with chronic diseases, so if you want to save money, that's where you have to go. And I'm very interested in primary care and rural medicine.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. I'm Diane Loeffler. I represent a portion of Northeast, the 15 neighborhoods in Northeast and Northern Southeast Minneapolis. And I have broad interest in the subject matter of this committee. When I'm not here, I work for Hennepin County. I've done that for some period of time, and as a policy analyst and planner. And so I work on a lot of different things, and you'll see that here. I've worked a lot on healthcare, our reimbursement systems, and healthcare reform, services for people with disabilities and people who are challenged by mental health, and services for children. It's really a wonderful committee with a broad scope, and look forward to working with all of you.
Susan Allen, District 62B is South Minneapolis. It's south of Lake Street, Central Avenue, Powderhorn, and the Field neighborhood in Regina. And these programs are vital to many constituents. A high number of children live in poverty. Until the redistricting, it was, I think, was high as over 50%. It's probably less now because we actually have a more diverse district now with Kingfield, which is high income. So it's a very interesting how that's going to play out. But these are programs that even in my own life I benefit. I would not be here if not for many of these programs. So,
thanks.
morning, or afternoon, I guess it is now. I'm Representative John Benson. 44B is my house district, which is Minnetonka and part of Plymouth. And I'm very happy to be on this committee, even though I'm a young child here on the committee. I'm interested in seeing to it that the Affordable Health Care Act gets implemented with consideration for the particular circumstances and the health care system that we have here in Minnesota, that it enhances it and doesn't detract from it. And I'm interested in the funding for nursing homes and several of the items that Representative Huntley just mentioned. But another reason is my wife is very much into health care, and I'm going to be her conduit, supposedly. So she insisted that I try to get on one of the healthcare committees. And so I'm pleased that I can report to her that I've succeeded. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank her for me.
Madam Chair, thank you. Will Morgan, I represent a portion of Burnsville and Lakeville, neighbor to Representative Mack over in Apple Valley. And I'm here to learn a lot. And I got to tell you, this first day assignment looks awfully daunting, Madam Chair. So if you're trying to scare me away, it just might work. So thank you very much. I look forward to serving.
Hello, everyone. My name is Serena Moran. I represent District 65A. That's in St. Paul, which is the Frogtown, Summit U, Midway, a little bit of North End, and a little portion of Cathedral Hill. And I am the vice chair of this committee. I have many passions and concerns around, you know, health and human service, some being definitely working to implement the Affordable Care Act and to make that the law of the land here in Minnesota and to create sustainable, affordable health care for all. Another interest of mine is out-of-home placement, the foster care system, in the child welfare system. And I think within all of this, the hope is that we can come out looking at how we can do our work through a strength-based model where we look at how we can provide for families in the state.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, members. And I really look forward to working with all of you. As I was thinking about how we're going to run the committee this year, first of all, it's obvious to everyone that we are going to have a very busy agenda. There is really a lot going on this year in health and human services. And part of my desire with the committee is to give everybody the opportunity to really learn the subject matter of this committee. And so I appreciate those of you who know that you're here to learn. We're all here to learn because I've been serving on Health and Human Services for 6 years, and believe me, there's an awful lot that I don't know. And so what I've done is, instead of the usual way we've done overviews in this committee, I've asked our nonpartisan staff, House staff, to be in charge of giving us some overviews so that we could kind of try a new way, because it's been my experience in the past that it's very hard to quickly understand how our health and human services system works. And so this is a little bit experimental. I've pushed them out of their comfort zones, I know, but I'm going to ask them. They're ready for it. They've been prepared, and we're going to, as we move along in this committee, we're going to rely on them more than we have in the past in the committee. And I know all of you do. One of their functions is to draft legislation and draft amendments for all of us and to answer our questions. But I'm going to ask them to be more active in the committee structure than they have been in the past so that they can give us more overviews to help us have a framework in which we can better understand the issues that we are going to be grappling with here, because it's really my view that, like the governor says, none of us is as smart as all of us, and I really would like us to all bring our minds together to try to grapple with some of these very difficult issues we're going to be facing. So just a word about the rules in the committee before we get going here, and that is that we are going to have some, but we don't have them today, so just you can expect that they'll be coming. And also, as we hear the presentation today, and if our staff would like to go and get set up there, that would be great. We do have a lot to cover, and so if you've got substantive questions, if you can hold them till the end, it would be great. But if you have a burning question that you need in order to understand what's being said, please go ahead and raise your hand. So if they use an acronym you don't understand, or you're just not sure what we're talking about, I really don't want you to miss it. I want you to understand it. I want us all to understand what's being explained here. So those kind of questions, please do ask them as we go. Okay, so.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just let me pile on. Just to tell the new members how great a cadre of House researchers we have. They are just stellar. They tell me I can't do things sometimes in some federal law or something, but I don't like them for that part. But they are really on top of their game, and we are a most fortunate committee to get that caliber.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Abler. I agree, and we're going to find that out. They're going to prove it to us as we go along. So it's a high bar, but absolutely. And as I said before, flattery will probably get you everywhere. So please go ahead and introduce yourselves for the tape.
Madam Chair, Randy Chun with House Research.
Lynn Aves with House Research.
And as you requested, House Research staff have prepared a presentation that summarizes the topical jurisdiction of the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. We'll also provide overview information on the various Health and Human Services programs and agency activities. There are a number of ways to present information about committee jurisdiction. A common approach would be to just focus on specific programs. Another approach might be to describe the various functions and divisions of each state agency. We've chosen a slightly different approach. We attempted to identify the major goals or themes of legislation, programs, and initiatives over which the committee has jurisdiction. And we realize that others may come up with, you know, different lists of themes or goals. So the major goals we identified are on your screen, providing support to individuals for basic needs, ensuring value in healthcare spending, addressing access to care, and ensuring quality and safety. And a summary outline of our presentation, you know, as well as the actual slides, are in your folders. Just a couple comments. This is a two-day presentation, so today we plan to talk about the first goal, providing support for basic needs. On the second day, we'll go over the remaining three goals, and if time permits, also address two topics that were of interest to the chair. One would be long-term care services, and the second, the use of managed care and county-based purchasing to provide services to state program enrollees. This presentation is geared to members who are relatively new to the HHS area, so some of this information will be very basic to those of you who have served for a number of years. This is a very general overview. Health and Human Services programs are often complex, and this presentation will skip over many of the fine details, and in the interest of time, we'll focus only on selected programs and initiatives. Various House research publications will provide more detailed information.
Back to MFIP funding, you had specified that as part of the federal funding, that comes from TANF funds and SNAP. And then we went over SNAP separate when it came to food assistance. So is SNAP administered kind of through two different mechanisms, through MFIP and then as a standalone program?
Madam Chair and Representative Mack, that's correct. It is part of the MFIP assistance program. The state actually has a waiver to administer it that way through MFIP. But there are also other people that receive SNAP benefits that aren't on MFIP that just receive the food benefits.
Other questions? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, since I am new to the committee, this question may be better to come later. But anyway, it seems that, you know, over these sessions, there's been ups and downs in the funding, based on partly ideology, I suppose, but also because of the structural deficit the state has been facing all these years. If we were to factor in inflation over the last, say, two or three or four sessions, what has been the buying power of this assistance? You know, I'm noticing $200 a month, extremely small amount of money. When you consider that, how are these families doing as far as keeping up with inflation over the last several sessions?
Yeah, Representative Benson,
that,
That might be, if you would hold that,
I will.
I have a question. I think that I think we're getting into an area here much more in depth, and we will circle back to this.
Okay,
I promise.
Thank you. That's why
if not now. Yes, thank you very much, but please hold that question. It's a very important one.
And Madam Chair, just quickly to Representative Benson's question, some of these programs do receive automatic increases in benefits, like the SNAP program, for example, does. Some of these other programs, the cash assistance, like GA or the cash portion of MFIP, has been something that's been set in statute and has not changed for several years.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Representative. How many years has that been with the cash assistance program? Is that 28 years? 1986?
Representative Fritz, that sounds about right for the MFIP cash benefits. I think it is the late 1980s was the last time the cash portion of that was increased, but I'd have to double check to make sure.
Thank you. Okay. Seeing no other questions, why don't you go ahead and do the next section?
Madam Chair, next we're going to move on to the social services programs, and the programs that we'll be talking about under that heading are group residential housing, the Minnesota Board on Aging, child welfare services, and services for vulnerable adults. So the first program that I'm going to go through is group residential housing. This is a state program that provides payments on behalf of eligible persons to pay for room and board and related housing services. GRH, once again, is administered by the counties under the supervision of the Department of Human Services. In order to be eligible for GRH payments, an individual must have county approval for residence in a GRH setting and must be aged blind or over 18 years of age and disabled, and must meet specified income and asset standards or belong to a category of individuals that are potentially eligible for general assistance. And I had those two slides previously that listed what those categories were. In order to receive GRH payments, a residential setting must have an agreement with the county to provide those services, and it must be either licensed or registered as a certain type of facility by either the Department of Health or the Department of Human Services. As of January 2012, there were over 5,500 residential settings that were receiving GRH payments, and the vast majority of those settings were adult foster care. An individual who is aged blind or over 18 years of age and disabled according to the criteria used by the Federal Social Security Program is eligible for GRH if he or she has income below the GRH monthly rate that's specified in the county's agreement with the GRH provider after making applicable deductions. And a person who belongs to a category of individuals potentially eligible for GA is eligible for group residential housing if he or she has countable income under the GA program minus the MA personal needs allowance that is less than the monthly rate specified in the county agency's agreement with the GRH provider, and they need to meet the GA asset standard. Nearly all GRH recipients qualify for the GRH basic room and board rate, which is currently set at $867 a month. And then there are some GRH recipients in certain settings that may also qualify for a supplemental payment that's in addition to that base rate. And then this next slide shows the funding and enrollment for the GRH program for fiscal year 2012. And next, I will be going quickly through the Minnesota Board on Aging. This is a 25-member board whose members are appointed by the governor. It's housed within the Department of Human Services, and the Department of Human Services provides the staffing for the board. One of the duties of the board is to administer funding that comes through the Federal Older Americans Act. In fiscal year 2012, the board received about $22.5 million in federal funds and $6.4 million in state funds for the programs that it administers. And some of the programs that are administered by the Board on Aging include the Senior Linkage Line, Minnesota Help, Senior Nutrition Services, Caregiver Grants, the Minnesota Senior Corps, and the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care.
Child welfare services include investigations, family assessments, protective services, foster care, and adoption for children who are alleged to be abused or neglected. Federal law requires each state to provide intervention and services to protect children from abuse and neglect. The legislature has established policies to implement the federal law. Again, funding comes from a variety of sources, as is true for most of the social services programs, federal, state, and county sources. Counties are responsible for investigating allegations of maltreatment in the home. If an allegation of maltreatment is received for a child outside the home, different agencies investigate those allegations, and those agencies are the ones that are contacted to commence those reports. I've listed on slide 47 what those agencies are. Law enforcement is required to investigate allegations if there's a violation of criminal law. Vulnerable adults are individuals 18 and older who are impaired physically, mentally, or emotionally and unable to protect themselves. They're also residents or inpatients of a facility, those who receive certain outpatient services or receive certain home care services. If someone has information that a vulnerable adult is being maltreated, a common entry point is available to accept phone calls 24 hours a day. The counties, the Department of Human Services, and the Minnesota Department of Health assess and investigate these allegations and allegations of financial exploitation. Counties provide protective services if they are needed.
Madam Chair, Randy Chun again with House Research. I guess if there aren't any questions, we can move on to the health care programs.
Questions, members? Okay, I'm not seeing any, so please proceed.
So we'll start first with the medical assistance program. MA is a jointly funded federal-state program that pays for health care services provided to eligible low-income persons. So medical assistance is the state's Medicaid program, and Medicaid was established by the federal government in 1965. Medicaid programs vary across states. Each state adopts its own operating and administrative standards, but remains within the broader parameters of federal law. And this pie chart is a comparison of state general fund spending for medical assistance and the previous income assistance and social services programs that Ms. Pennelly went over. And as you can tell from this, the MA program is the largest single expenditure item by a large margin within the DHS general fund budget. The Minnesota Care program, which is a health care program that I'll be discussing later, is paid for out of the health care access fund. But for sake of comparison, spending for this Minnesota Care program is about 6% of this DHS general fund budget if you were to make a comparison. So this would make it the second largest expenditure item in the DHS budget. So the point being that the two largest, expenditure programs are health care programs. Getting to now the administration of MA, county agencies enroll individuals and administer MA under the supervision of DHS. DHS reimburses fee-for-service providers using fee schedules that are established by the agency or by the state. DHS also contracts with managed care and county-based purchasing plans and provides these plans with a monthly capitation payment for each enrollee. So under fee-for-service, providers are generally paid for each separate service, so total provider reimbursement increases with the amount of services that are provided. Under capitation, this payment is fixed, so a capitated payment doesn't increase or decrease with the amount of services provided.
And if I could just interrupt for a second, Mr. Chun, just to mention to members who are new to this whole process that you're going to hear the term PMAP a lot, and that is what we're discussing here. It stands for Prepaid Medical Assistance Program, and that's this capitation amount that we pay to HMOs, to managed care plans that is most of how we deliver our public program health care in the state. Oh, I'm sorry, and Representative Huntley had a question.
Madam Chair and Mr. Chun, if you go back to the chart on page 50, could you get us the numbers on the medical assistance? What percentage of that goes to people with disabilities? What percent goes to nursing homes and waivered people? And what percentage goes to the moms with small children?
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, there is a slide that I guess Ms. Pinelli will go over tomorrow in the it's page 129 of the slide packet, but that's a topic that will be covered tomorrow.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions, so you can proceed.
Okay, Madam Chair, moving now to eligibility for MA. In order to be eligible for the program, a person must belong to an eligible group, meet income and asset limits, be a U.S. citizen or a legal non-citizen who meets certain criteria. MA also provides up to 3 months of retroactive coverage from the time of application if the person would have been eligible during that time period. Now moving to eligible groups, MA coverage is available for children, parents and caretakers, pregnant women, elderly, persons with disabilities, and adults without children. Coverage for adults without children was added on March 1st of 2011, and extending coverage to this group basically allows all major groups of individuals to qualify for MA if they meet the program requirements. Prior to this date, adults without children were covered only if they also fell into some other category, such as being elderly or disabled. MA income limits vary by eligibility group and are set as a percentage of the federal poverty guidelines. Federal poverty guidelines are dollar amounts that increase with family size, and these are updated annually by the federal government. There's a separate handout in your packet that lists the dollar amounts for different levels of the federal poverty guidelines and different family sizes. And the remainder of this slide lists the income limits for the major MA eligibility groups. Now, in order to determine whether a person meets the income limit, the state needs to use an income methodology to determine what income counts toward that income limit. So currently, in determining income eligibility, the MA program excludes or disregards various types of income. So it sort of functions as a net income standard. Beginning January 1st of 2014, the Federal Affordable Care Act, or ACA, will require states to use modified adjusted gross income for parents, children, and adults without children. The ACA will also require states to use a standard 5% income disregard for groups that are subject to this modified adjusted gross income standard. This would replace existing state income disregards. Individuals who have income above the program income limit can also qualify by sending down. This is done by incurring medical bills in amounts that exceed the amount of income that's in excess of what's called a spend-down limit. And these spend-down limits are 100% of the poverty guidelines for families and children, 75% of poverty for the aged, blind, and disabled. And there's no spend-down option for adults without children. Some MA enrollees must meet asset standards. Parents and caretakers have a higher asset standard than the elderly, blind, and disabled, and those are listed on this slide. There's no asset limit for pregnant women, children, and adults without children. And the Affordable Care Act will prohibit asset limits for parents as well as for pregnant women, children, and adults without children beginning in January 1st of 2014. Federal Medicaid law designates certain health care services as mandatory for states to cover and others as optional. The Minnesota Medicaid program covers all federally mandated and most optional health care services. And there's a separate handout in your folders. It's something from the Department of Human Services website called Summary of Coverage, Cost Sharing, and Limits. So this, for both the Minnesota CARE and MA program, this handout lists covered services and also gives details about the cost-sharing requirements that apply to those programs. The MA benefit tends to be comprehensive compared to private sector coverage. For example, MA usually covers a wider range of long-term care services than the typical private sector policy. As mentioned, cost-sharing requirements apply to certain MA enrollees. The MA program does not charge enrollee premiums, but the enrollees are subject to a family deductible and various co-payments, and again, those are listed on the handout. Cost sharing under federal law needs to be nominal for most enrollees, you know, because of their low income. Total monthly cost sharing can't exceed 5% of income for persons with incomes at or below 100% of the poverty guidelines. And children and pregnant women are exempt from cost sharing. MA is financed jointly by the state and federal government. The federal government provides a 50% match toward the cost of medical assistance services for Minnesota. This is a percentage that varies by states. It's done on a formula that takes into account state per capita income. And the state general fund pays the remaining 50%, and there's a county share for a limited number of services. The Federal Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, provides an enhanced match of 65% toward the cost of certain services. And this next slide presents information on MA spending and enrollment for fiscal year 2012. Move now to the Minnesota CARE program. This is a smaller and less costly program than medical assistance. It's a jointly funded federal-state program. Provide subsidized health coverage to low to moderate income families, children, and adults without children. And it was established in 1992 as part of a broader state health care access legislation. The program is administered by the state through the DHS Central Office. DHS accepts applications, determines eligibility, and contracts with managed care and county-based purchasing plans to provide service to enrollees. And all Minnesota CARE enrollees receive services through these prepaid plans. County agencies have the option of processing applications and determining eligibility. In order to be eligible for Minnesota CARE, individuals must meet income limits. Adults who are not pregnant must meet an income standard. Individuals must also meet requirements related to lack of access to health insurance, be Minnesota residents, and be citizens or legal non-citizens. The program has different income limits for different groups. There's no income limit for children, and this was a change that was made recently. Parents have an income limit of 275% of poverty or $57,500, whichever is less. And adults without children have an income limit of 250% of the federal poverty guidelines. The Minnesota CARE asset limit is $10,000 for an individual and $20,000 for households of two or more, with various assets being excluded. Pregnant women and children are exempt from the asset limit. Minnesota CARE also has requirements related to lack of access to health insurance, and these are referred to sometimes as insurance barriers. So applicants must have no health coverage at the time of application and for four prior months, no access to employer-subsidized insurance at the time of application, and no access through this through the current employer at the time of application and for 18 prior months. And employer-subsidized insurance is defined as when the employer pays 50% or more of the premium costs for that individual. The four-month uninsured and the no access to employer-subsidized insurance requirements do not apply to children with household incomes not exceeding 200% of the federal poverty guideline. And the initial rationale for these insurance barriers was to prevent the erosion of private sector insurance coverage. Minnesota CARE has several...
Excuse me, Mr. Yes. Chun. Representative Huntley has a question.
Madam Chair and members... The no health coverage at the time of application and for four prior months, that means if somebody's on medical assistance working and they get a $10 an hour raise, they get kicked off of medical assistance and they have to wait 4 months to get on Minnesota Care, which is one of the, that churning is one of the big problems we have.
Mr. Chun?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, that is the general effect, but the Minnesota Care Law also has some exceptions for people coming off the medical assistance program, so that there are a few exceptions, but if you're coming off, say, private sector coverage, you know, there is that issue.
Okay. Other questions since we're paused here? Okay. Continue, Mr. Chun.
I guess moving on to then covered services, there are several benefit sets for the Minnesota Care Program. Pregnant women and children have access to the broadest range of services, which is nearly all MA benefits. Parents and adults without children are eligible for most MA services, but certain benefit limits apply. For example, a $10,000 annual limit on inpatient hospital costs applies to certain enrollees within this group. And adults without children with incomes equal to or greater than 200% of the federal poverty guidelines don't receive a fixed set of benefits. They are covered by the Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program, which is a defined contribution program. So their benefit set or their benefit coverage is what they purchase, you know, through the defined contribution. For premiums and cost sharing, Minnesota Care enrollees pay premiums based on a sliding scale. So payments range from a minimum payment of $4 a month to 7.2% of gross income. There are no premiums charged for children with incomes less than or equal to 200% of the poverty guidelines. A family deductible and various co-payments and co-insurance requirements apply. Again, those are listed on that separate sheet from the DHS website. Adults without children, again, covered under this defined contribution program, do not pay premiums, but they instead pay any cost of private sector coverage that exceeds the amount of their defined contribution, and they are subject to whatever cost-sharing requirements apply to the policy that they purchase. Minnesota Care receives a 50% federal match. Again, there are certain children receive a higher match from the federal Children's Health Insurance Program. The state pays the remaining costs out of the Health Care Access Fund. And the Health Care Access Fund is funded by a 2% tax on the gross revenues of health care providers and a 1% tax on nonprofit health plan premiums. And under current law, the tax on health care providers will expire for the tax year beginning January 1 of 2020. Prior to that, the tax rate can be reduced if there is a surplus in the Health Care Access Fund that meets specified criteria. Also, the federal waiver that authorizes a federal match for Minnesota Care services expires December 31st of 2013, and it's not known whether or not the federal government will renew this waiver given everything else that's going on with the Affordable Care Act. This next slide presents Minnesota Care spending and enrollment figures for fiscal year 2012.
I'm going to talk briefly about chemical health and mental health care.
Ms. Reeves, before you do there, I just want to see, first of all, if there are any clarifying questions that the members have. And if not, I just wanted to, before we move on from that, kind of get Mr. Chun to just sort of give us in a sentence that if in case some newer members sort of haven't understood the relationship between our large medical assistance program and our smaller Minnesota Care program, kind of just to make sure that members understand that what the relationship is between those two things. In other words, where I'm going, Mr. Chun, I might as well just say and see if I'm doing this correctly, is just that basically, our Minnesota Care program is a program more or less for working but low-income folk who don't have access to health insurance, correct? Whereas our Medicaid program is more for lower-income people.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, since you're fishing for questions, just have a And so just also to point out, the Minnesota Care is meant to be temporary. It wasn't meant to be the building block of our whole thing back in the beginning. And so it's about to go away probably anyway, so that's almost irrelevant. But just, Mr. Chun, I just get it clear in my own head. The $10,000 hospital cap does not apply. It applies to everybody except for pregnant women and children. Is that right? Under, is there an income level for the children it doesn't apply to? Or can you just clarify that? That's always a point that comes up.
Madam Chair, Reps of Abler, the $10,000 annual limit applies to, on inpatient services, applies to all adults without children, and it applies to the higher income parents. These would be parents with incomes greater than the greater than 215% of the poverty guidelines.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry, Ms. Aves. Go ahead.
That's absolutely fine.
I have to interrupt you. I'm glad you said it was fine. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just on slide number 68 under Minnesota Care, it says pregnant women and children have access to a broader range of services, nearly all MA benefits than adults who are not pregnant. See separate handout. Is that this income and asset guideline?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, there's a document. This is what it looks like. It's from the Department of Human Services website called Summary of Coverage, Cost Sharing, and Limits.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, we'll try it again.
Counties are responsible for providing chemical dependency treatment services for residents of their counties who meet specified criteria. Generally, it's through a Rule 25 assessment that's done by a county assessor. The Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund provides funding for low-income individuals who meet the clinical requirements and certain household and income guidelines. There's a standardized percentage of county share at 22.95% of the cost of services. Counties are also responsible for developing mental health systems for children and adults that have to comply with the requirements of the Children's Mental Health Act and the Adult Mental Health Act. Funding comes from federal, state, and county sources. Public health care programs and private insurance pay for some of the mental health services. Some of the services for children and adults include case management, residential treatment, day treatment, crisis intervention, and outpatient counseling. Schools are also one of the greatest providers of mental health treatment and care for children. State-operated services is a group of health care services for individuals with complex needs related to mental illness, chemical dependency, developmental disabilities, brain injury, and individuals who have been committed to one of the treatment facilities as mentally ill and dangerous. These services are funded through general fund appropriations, Medicare, medical assistance, private insurance, counties, and clients' personal funds. This is really a broad, wide array of services. The adult mental health services include services at the community behavioral health hospitals, services at the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter for those who are mentally ill and dangerous, adults who are committed as developmentally disabled who pose a risk to public safety. There are various services for children and adolescents, individuals who are chemically dependent, and individuals who are developmentally disabled who need services in the community. They also provide rehab services for individuals with serious brain injuries and neurocognitive disorders who have difficult behaviors.
Madam Chair, the state also administers a number of program integrity initiatives that are related to the health care and the income assistance and social service programs. DHS health care programs contain a number of procedures and initiatives to reduce provider fraud and improper payments. These include activities such as providing assistance and training to providers, conducting medical reviews, doing various edits during the claims processing process, operating a surveillance and integrity review section to investigate provider and recipient fraud, The department has recently implemented a program to contract for provider audits on a contingent basis to recover overpayments and identify underpayments. And DHS also established the Office of Inspector General in 2011 to reduce fraud and abuse in a range of program areas.
Madam Chair, Danielle Pinelli from House Research again. Continuing on with provider fraud prevention, as Mr. Chun just mentioned, DHS has the Office of Inspector General, which oversees fraud prevention and recovery efforts. The state and counties work together to prevent public assistance fraud. The state funds a county-administered program called the Integrity Reinvestment Project, which pays for preventing and investigating fraud in the state's cash assistance, child care, health care, and food programs. Fraud prevention programs prevent and reduce improper payments by resolving eligibility questions for caseworkers. The Department of Human Services has a fact sheet titled Minnesota Welfare Fraud Prevention and Reduction Efforts. It's on their website. It looks like this. And it's got a lot of statistics about the fraud prevention and reduction efforts, including in fiscal year 2011, fraud investigators completed 6,900 investigations, identified $13.7 million in cost avoidance and overpayments, responded to 7,050 fraud complaints and verification requests, and stopped disbursement of or identified for collection $4.67 for every $1 spent on fraud program administrative costs. And Madam Chair, I believe this concludes what we were going to go through today, unless members have questions.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Pugnelli. Are there questions? Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just a a general comment for the committee and just food for thought. You know, back to number 68 there, about a year and a half ago or so, I had a young lady come into my office. She was in her 20s, and she needed health insurance. And she was pretty tight financially. And I just asked her if she, if it was difficult for her to afford the premium, if she qualified for any, you know, county services in that area. She said she had been up there, but that she didn't qualify. And then she added that the local social worker had told her if she'd get pregnant, there were all types of benefits they could sign her up for, okay? So, sometimes I think there's the law of unintended consequences, but in this young lady's case, I asked her, do you want to do that? She said, no. And I just wonder, in some cases, if we might be sending the wrong message in certain situations. Again, food for thought, but that was a specific example that came to my office.
Well, Representative Grunhagen, you asked her if she was interested in getting pregnant?
Well, she said it in a way.
You missed the joke there.
It was a private conversation. I won't give her name out. But she just stated it, as a matter of fact, that the social worker had told that, and she said it kind of incredulously, like, I can't believe she said that. So I just responded, and I said, well, do you want to do that? She said, no.
Well, Representative Grunhagen, jokes aside, as everybody, I think, will learn more about, a lot of these things are going to be changing now because of the Affordable Care Act. And one of the things, in fact, a bill we'll be hearing very soon, is going to expand the eligibility for medical assistance to adults without children above the current level, which is 75% of poverty, as we just heard. So the people we're covering right now under what was known as the early expansion option, which Governor Dayton took advantage of, those were the very poor adults without children, the ones who used to be on our general assistance medical care program. And now we're going to be expanding medical assistance to more people, so it will no longer be necessary if it is now. And obviously for some things, adults, parents with children were eligible for certain things mm-hmm. that without children they were not. You're correct, but that is going to be changing to a great degree. Am I correct, Mr. Chun? if at least under what's proposed. Obviously, we don't know what's going to be
happening. Madam Chair and members, I mean, that's correct. The Affordable Care Act offers a number of different coverage options. Some of them are options for the state. Some of them are, you know, more or less sort of mandated through the operation of the health insurance exchange.
Right. So, so Representative Grunhagen, to the degree that we had that perverse incentive in that particular case, I think that that's going to be going away. Other comments? Representative, I think Representative Huntley's next on the list, and then we'll get to...
Yeah, I just had, Madam Chair, a question for Danelle. You don't need to do it today, but on the fraud prevention, that's slide 77, I'd like to sort of a breakdown on what percentage of that fraud is coming from providers and what percentage is coming from recipients who are getting services they shouldn't get. Because the big national news is providers that are supposedly doing personal care attendance type of things, but there's no real patients even involved.
Representative Fritz and then Loft.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Well, my example of a constituent is a friend of mine, a 52, 53-year-old woman who's a business owner and has owned her own business for a number of years in my lovely hometown of Northfield. And she makes about $7,000 a year after expenses and lives on that. And so she does appreciate Minnesota Care. And every time I see her, she thanks me for voting, you know, for it and for having it. So the need is tremendous. And, you know, it really is very needed by many women, working women still that age, who find themselves either widowed or divorced. Some widows do not have pensions of their husbands or their own. They still have to work for a living and provide for themselves, and health care is at $7,000 a year. She could not afford it, and she needs to take care of herself at that age.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and just in serious to Representative Grunhagen's question, I mean, as you can tell, we have decided that people who are pregnant need to have access to services to make sure that that child gets prenatal care and the mother gets prenatal care, that potential disabilities and other complications are attended to early in that pregnancy. And so we have been more generous in access to health care and nutrition services and other things. And so it's actually a required question if they're trying to screen someone, and it probably was that the financial worker or some working with that person, women get taken aback when someone says, are you pregnant? That's kind of considered a rude question, and she may have just been trying to explain that it changes and your benefit eligibility changes based on that, not implying that that was a strategy to get better services.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Other questions?
Madam Chair.
A few minutes, Representative Abler.
Well, just something that I was thinking of, and your comment about the changes that are going to happen. Isn't the ACA, maybe Mr. Chun knows this, the ACA changes mostly the health care side. It doesn't change the MFIP services and the disability services and that whole other bit of our human services law, right? It's mostly focused on health care, getting medical assistance, health care, and like that. Isn't that right, Mr. Chun?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, I mean, that's correct. The ACA just pretty much focus on healthcare programs, on expanding coverage, on, you know, sort of workforce issues. There's some anti-fraud initiatives and so on.
So we'll have this question next year, too, I think, is the point. So about the pregnant women. And
yeah, Representative Abler, I think the one place where it might be related, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Mr. Chun or anybody else, is that on the exchange that's being set up here in Minnesota, that the exchange will also determine eligibility for other programs besides health care. Am I correct in that?
Madam Chair, I believe that that's sort of an option for the states to consider in designing the exchange.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, and this is a good moment to remind members that we are having a meeting tonight, 6 to 8, where it will be everything you always wanted to know about the ACA, I think. And, well, maybe I'm overstating it a bit. But anyway, we are the four health care committees in the House and Senate are meeting, and it should try to just have everybody have a base of information about the Affordable Care Act, because this is going to frame a lot of our discussion this year. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question on logistics. It's obviously going to be a lot of members from the House and Senate. Is there going to be seating reserved in the first couple rows of the audience, or just try to get there early and we're going to squeeze around the table in close quarters, or...
Okay, I am told, I think we'll probably do both. Usually in these big meetings, we try to squeeze around the table, but there will be reserved seating in the audience as well. I think it's, there probably isn't a room big enough for all of us to be at the table. Thank you.
I'm early.
Okay.
I'm early.
Thank you to our House research staff, and if there are no other questions, the meeting is adjourned.